Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I am Cindy House. I host this podcast. I am also here with Lizzie No. Hey, Lizzie.
Hey, Cindy.
So if you want to stay in touch with Basic Folk, sign up for our newsletter, basicfolk.com. That's where you can do that. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. I wanted to bring up that Lizzie No, back on Twitter.
Back on Twitter, baby. I have a new handle. Lizzie No is dead. R.I.P. to Handsome Lizzie. We had a really great 8-year run.
How are you doing? What's happening?
I just got home from a mountaintop experience. When I was a college student at Stanford University, there was this great bluegrass festival that I used to go to that was free. It's called Hardly Strictly Bluegrass, and it is the benchmark that I set for myself as a college student. Like, if I make it and I work hard, like someday I will be able to play this festival. And this weekend I played the festival. Thank you for the applause. I am proud of myself. There's something about reaching a goal that you actually set. When a good thing happens and it's a surprise, that's cool. But I feel like it's so much better if you actually, like, you know, write it in your journal and then years later it happens, you know, like completing the loop.
So how did you feel at the mountaintop?
It felt amazing. I felt competent and calm and comfortable and a little bit ecstatic, which I rarely feel. I have depression. I feel like a lot of the time, even like on my birthday or even if I'm like receiving jewelry, like I'm trying to think of like the most like pleasurable things. Like if I'm eating a piece of chocolate, like I'll think to myself, like, this is pretty great. And I still feel a little sad. But when I was on stage, I was like, I am completely at home and at peace. It was a great feeling. And Emmy Lou was sitting side stage next to my boyfriend Cole watching and reportedly at least once was heard saying, wow. So that's the most I'm going to ever brag on this podcast.
Can you tell us about the interaction with Emmy Lou?
She kind of acted like we were old friends. She was like, oh, hey. And I was like, would you mind if I took a picture with you? And she's like, wait, I thought we've already been taking photos today. So she was like, get over here, buddy.
That's amazing.
Another fun celebrity run-in I had this weekend was I was backstage watching Aruj Aftab's set. She is so brilliant. And I felt like my body remained on the ground, but myself had lifted up a few feet above into the sky. Like I felt like lightheaded. And afterwards I was just crying and crying. And I like turned to the person next to me and I was like, that was crazy. I can't stop crying. And he was like, I know, me too. And that person was Elvis Costello.
No way.
We were crying.
Oh, wow. Lizzie, is that also a journal entry that you had hoped to cry side stage with Elvis Costello?
That is a little too specific, but maybe I'll write it now and backdate it.
I went to, so this was about a month ago when this episode comes out, but I went to the Fresh Grass Festival in North Adams in Massachusetts at Mass Mocha.
Oh my gosh, that looked so dreamy. It looked so beautiful.
It was very fun. And one of my favorite sets of the weekend was Taj Mahal. He just was like magnificent and funny and charming and just like full of energy. All weekend long, I was like on a mission. I was like, I'm going to get a picture with Taj Mahal. So I tapped his tour manager's shoulder and I was like, hey, and he was about to go on stage in like 5 minutes. And I was like, is it possible to get a picture with Taj? And he was like, not right now. And then he told me to come back 15 minutes after the set. I was like, okay, no problem. And then I said, my father went to UMass Amherst with Taj, and they both were in the animal husbandry program, and I wanted to get a picture for my dad. So thanks, I'll come back later. And I'm walking by, and I saw the tour manager, Tim, talking to Taj about me, like the interaction that he had just had. And then I heard Tim say, well, do you want to say hi now? And Taj went, yeah. So then
he
starts talking to me, and he's like, you're Lewis's daughter. You're Lewis's daughter. And I was like, hang on, let me put this food down.
Yeah.
And then I got to talk to him for a few minutes and get a picture with him, like, before he went on stage. So
Cindy, that's
like
amazing.
Very cool.
I would say that I am about 1/1000th as cool and dazzling as Taj Mahal. And I don't want to talk to anyone before I go on stage. Like, my family, my closest loved ones, my greatest heroes, like, they can wait until after I'm done working. So the fact that you got that pre-show hang and you got to, like, soak up the pre-show glow with Taj Mahal is so cool.
Are you the type of person who, when you get home from tour, you unpack immediately, or does it take a while?
Oh, absolutely not. And I'm actually at the point now where I've gotten busy enough and procrastinate-y enough that I'm often not fully unpacking my suitcase until I leave for the next tour, which may happen now. Like, sometimes it's like a week between tours. There's no time. All of that laundry.
I was listening to the Jillian Michaels podcast, my problematic hero, Jillian Michaels.
Is she the exercise lady?
She's the exercise lady that yells at people on The Biggest Loser that no one likes, but I actually like kind of like her, but somebody
it's okay. I'm a huge fan of Tom Cruise.
Oh, wow. All right. On her podcast, somebody wrote in and was like, what do I do if I like can't work out and I have like very demanding deadlines? And Jillian Michaels' answer was, well, do you have time to watch your favorite TV shows?
Yeah.
And that was it. And the lady was like, yes, I do. And she was like, mm-hmm. Great.
You have time to work out. Are you saying I have time to unpack my suitcase?
I was just like a roundabout passive-aggressive way.
Did my boyfriend get to you? Because I'm sort of...
Cole and I are in an alliance.
I feel like this conspiracy goes all the way to the top, and I will be investigating, and we will find the source of the corruption.
Our episode 200 is coming up.
Oh my God, next, Cindy.
Like early next year. We have to think about what we want to do for it. So normally, so for episode 100, we celebrated, and episode 150, both times we celebrated by me interviewing a white lady.
So groundbreaking.
Yeah, very groundbreaking. A white lady interviewing a white lady.
It's some call it white on white crime.
Yeah.
Why don't we have a party? Like, why don't we have like a live party where we interview duos? Like, only duos are allowed. Like, we'll get Watch House. We'll get Tedeschi and Trucks. We'll get Beyonce and Jay-Z. Like, the accessible.
Jay-Z and Kanye.
No. Absolutely not.
No. Absolutely.
We're done with him.
I said that to get a rise out of you. Haven't we been done with him for a while?
I have.
Just keeps. Yeah.
Something that is like so dear to me about my partner, Cole, is that he's like a big shoe guy, but he has stopped wearing Yeezys. Even a white guy who's really into shoes has realized like, ooh, this isn't a good look anymore. If Cole can do it, you can do it. Guys, basic folk listeners, I'm not saying like, let's bully someone. I just feel like we can be done.
Do you think basic folk listeners has like a, there's like a big percentage of basic folk listeners that like listen to Kanye?
I'm not sure. And you guys should write in on Twitter and let us know. But I do want to say that like, if you're not listening to Kanye because you're like not a huge hip hop listener, like that's totally normal and fine. There have been times over the years where I've thought, I feel like people are criticizing Kanye for racist reasons. But now it's coming back around where like everybody needs to criticize Kanye for anti-racist reasons. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
It's come back around.
I think so. And if you wait long enough, it'll go back around again.
Yeah, that's probably true. So if you make sure you're criticizing Kanye for anti-racist reasons is what I'm trying to say.
Well, this is, you know, this is how we loop it back to Basic Folk, because we are going round and round in the circle game. And we've already discussed that Joni Mitchell has done blackface.
She has.
So everyone loses.
And this is yet another endorsement for Buffy St. Marie's Little Wheel, Spin and Spin, a better song by a wonderful singer-songwriter that we love.
Today on Basic Folk, Lizzie No talks to Molly Obomsawin.
Are y'all ready for a crossover? Yes, they were heard screaming.
Yes.
Yeah. So Molly is one of my favorite crossover stars in the making. She is a folk artist who a lot of our listeners might know from her wonderful folk trio, Lula Wiles. And she and other members of her band have been guests on Basic Folk in the past, talking about Lula Wiles' albums. Her upcoming project, Sweet Tooth, however, is her debut as a jazz band leader and composer. And it is an absolute blessing, knockout. Can I say masterpiece? Do I know enough about jazz to call it a masterpiece? I will call it a masterpiece. This record is so, so interesting from beginning to end. There are a lot of field recordings included in Sweet Tooth that Molly intentionally shared to shine a light on the roots and the movement of her community, the Abenaki people, who are native to like the northeast of the US and Canada. Their history is really complex, and she does a lot of great explaining in our conversation about those tribal movements and some of the violence that they've endured. Molly takes a really experimental approach to recording these stories and sharing her own stories. She includes a lot of improvisation. There are chants that she wrote. There are recordings of elders. And then there's like her singular, warm, haunting voice. So we went track by track in this conversation, talking about Sweet Tooth, talking about her experience as a folk artist, as a jazz artist, and as an activist in the Land Back movement. I think that this episode is a really great introduction to intersectionality for folks that might be wanting to learn more about that term, because Molly and I are always, like, as friends and as musicians and colleagues, like, kind of trying to dig into the politics of gender and race and nationality, and how those three identities can intersect within one artist. And Molly is such a great example of this, and she's such a leader in advocating for like indigenous and gender freedom. So her music is important, and it's kind of heartbreaking. And there are also moments where it's a lot of fun. Please, 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 please go buy her album. It's so freaking good.
All right. We're going to go track by track on the new record, which is called Sweet Tooth. And I'm really looking forward to this. Molly is the coolest. Let's get into it. This is Lizzie No talking to Molly Obomsawin on Basic Folk.
Molly, thank you so much for coming back to Basic Folk. It is so great to have you here.
Thank you for having me here. Excited.
Well, I've told you a couple of pre-interview things to keep in mind, but I'm also going to tell them to the listeners. One of them is that you have been on Basic Folk before in 2021. It's a really great interview with Cindy. And I think everyone should go back and listen to that interview, because I'm not covering the basics in this interview. They might be like, where is she from? Where did she go to school? Who are her influences? And guess what? I don't care.
Yeah, this is, we're taking the basic out of Basic Folk for this one.
Yeah, this is extreme folk. We're jumping into new music and new horizons.
That's right.
The other contextual excuse that I'm going to give is that your new album covers like multiple so-called countries, languages, and I'm going to do my very best with pronunciation, but I want you to correct me when you feel comfortable, and I want our listeners to know that I am not an expert.
Fuck yeah, you got it.
Okay, here we go. Extreme Folk with Molly Obomsawin. So, like many of our listeners, I first became your fan through your work as a bassist, singer, and songwriter for the folk trio Lula Wiles. And I think I saw you guys play at City Winery in like 2018, and I was like, who are these cool ladies? Uh-huh. But this new album, Sweet Tooth, is a completely different creature. So how do you show up differently as a band leader of a jazz project than you do as a folk singer? And like, by that same token, do you feel like audiences receive you differently in the jazz space than they do in the folk world?
Ooh, just going in. Okay.
Yeah, I said it was extreme folk.
This is extreme. Okay. Cool. Well, first of all, like, I feel very differently being a front person, and it's definitely something that, like, I didn't quite have a full appreciation for, I think, when I was mostly being a bassist in Lula Wiles. Like, we did have kind of a concept that we were all sharing lead roles, but, like, in effect, like, I was very much, like, the bassist who sometimes sang songs, you know?
Right.
And band leading is really hard, and like being on stage and being the one responsible for talking is like so hard. I hate it.
Dude, I feel like one of the main themes on Basic Folk that like almost every guest shares is like talking is so fucking hard.
It's the worst. We shouldn't be expected.
So many musicians are like, I play music because I don't like talking. And then this weird side project of the job is having to talk all the time.
Yeah.
So do you feel like very different in your body on stage when you realize like you are the center of attention versus like I am one of three in a band?
Yeah, I'm definitely getting used to it. I will say, so we just finished a tour together where I was not doing Sweet Tooth, but I was playing guitar and singing and, you know, doing that thing. And that to me is less comfortable than like showing up as a front person with a bass.
Interesting.
So yeah, there's a lot.
Why do you think that is?
Probably because I dedicated my entire life to playing the bass. And so I just feel like I like own it more and I feel like I earned it. Whereas like, I don't know, maybe we got into this a little bit on tour, but like anyone can play the guitar. And frankly, if you play folk music, like eventually you're going to have to be playing the guitar. So, so like it kind of feels, I feel like I'm like cheating or like, I don't know what, like just like less authentic in myself, which maybe, I don't know, like you do have to like show up and fake it and like talk on stage. So like maybe that fits in the role, but
yeah, well, that's my whole career. I had no plans to play guitar and like do the solo thing. I think, yeah, there's always that sense of like, are people going to see through me? But I have to say, I've seen you perform now quite a few times and you're like very in your body, in yourself. When you're playing guitar, I think it.
Thank you.
No one can notice if that's what you're worried about.
Cool.
Now, here's another easy question: do you have a working definition of folk music?
Oof, dang, that's a great question that I'm so happy to answer.
Great. Bring
I feel
it on.
Like, okay, so
I've actually never asked a guest that before, but I'm really interested to hear what you have to say because of the incredible album of yours that we're about to talk about. I think it really hits at this like intersection of jazz, folk, field recordings, etc. So tell me what you think folk music is.
Yes. Okay. First of all, I think folk music is there's like a continuum, right? The like folk, rock, jazz continuum. It's not like a clean, like, you know, there are no boundaries or borders in those definitions.
My ears just perked up when I heard no borders. We're going to put a pin in that.
Dismantle colonial borders, number one. But when, you know, I feel like I've gone through a big journey with folk music because I grew up doing a lot of like New England folk music, which is very specific, really kind of dorky subculture of New England. And then I went to music school for a hot second. I really said that. and then like it was kind of like bludgeoned into my brain that folk music is only like traditional Appalachian fiddle music, and if like anything else is happening, I know.
If I just made an obscene gesture. I'm sorry to our listeners, but
extreme
luckily
folk.
You didn't have to see it.
Yeah. Maybe we'll release the video of this to like heavy subscribers. So, You know, when I, Lulu Wiles is no longer a working entity. I don't know if that's out yet, but it's out now.
That's a scoop that we are releasing here on Basic Folk.
Yes. And when that news kind of hit the floor, I was like, okay, whatever I do next, like, who knows what it's going to be, but like, I don't really feel like it's going to be folk music in the way that like people associate Lulu Wiles with folk music, although it's like quite not really folk music what Lulu Wiles did, but also that's fine. Do, you know, do what you will with your definitions.
But it had enough of the trappings of folk music to pass.
Yes. Yeah, it was folk passing. And when I wrote Sweet Tooth, I had this kind of question of like, am I gonna lose all my folk fans because I made a jazz album? And I really sat with that for a long time and realized that like I was the one who got to define it, and definitely, you know, this is the folk music of Wabanaki people, right? And that was like a big thing that I landed on, was like, I think the scene that you and I are in, Lizzie, more or less, is like very dedicated to this idea that like folk music looks and sounds a certain way and has only a certain number of influences if we're talking about the American context, right? And like, but folk is a global term, first of all, and I think the real like dissonance comes when like, you know, Wabanaki indigenous music here isn't even world music. It's not like global folk music. It's at home folk music, right?
So so if I'm hearing you correctly, the problem is America and Americana. Like, folk music is just the music of a people, I think.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, I had a sense when I listened to this album that that was sort of your definition as well.
Sweet. Good read. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's jump into Sweet Tooth. It is an incredible album. And I want to go track by track because there are three movements in this album, each with like a particular story to tell. So the first track is called Odana, which Odana, I believe, means Odana. See, here's my first mispronunciation. Odana, which translates to the village. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about physical landscape elements of your upbringing that found their way into this song?
Whoa, cool. Yeah. So, right, Odana is the village. Odanak is the reservation. The K edition means like at the village, basically.
At the village, okay.
And it's the place where all the people went during the colonial wars and to get away from various plagues that extremely dirty pilgrims brought. They didn't know how to shower at that time. We had to teach them. And so Odanak is like...
Some are still learning,
I'm afraid to say.
Some are still learning.
Extreme folk. And so Odanak is at the northern part of our territory, and I grew up, I was born in like the middle part of our territory. My sister was born in the western part. I now live in the eastern part, so I've like kind of been all over it. But my upbringing has been basically, I kind of define Wabanaki or Abenaki territory as like between the Lake Champlain River Valley, so like the Green Mountains and the Adirondacks over there, and the kind of western foothills in central Maine, and Yeah, so a lot of mountains, a lot of waterways. I guess our territory is also like defined by waterways because that's how we got around everywhere. Yeah, they were like our highways.
Can you tell me a little bit about the story of Odina? Like, I know there may be elements of it that you would prefer not to share with a wide audience. And if that's the case, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so... yeah, the story basically, it starts out honoring Odinak. It says, like, Odinak, beloved ancestral place, basically, the place that our grandfathers or our, like, passed on elders founded for us and protected for us, and basically, like, the heart of our nation. That's kind of what it starts out by saying. And then it goes on to... talk about this specific place in the western part of the territory called Mazipskoy, where we had a village that was like a satellite village. And it talks about how we were forced out of that place. And it says, you know, throughout the song, we're thanking the ancestors and we're saying basically like great forests and landscapes extend from our former villages. Basically it's overgrown, like, because we're no longer able to be there. And so we have to stay vigilant to protect the one place that will be forever ours. It's a really sad, tragic story. But it's also, you know, a story of like gratitude, like both mourning and gratitude because like we are here because of this particular village.
Wow. So in a sense, it's like even the existence of the village is not the whole story. Like the village is like a remnant of a much bigger thing that existed and a bigger sort of homeland that existed before these wars and plagues.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Odinak was founded, it's not like an ancient village place where we've always been, right? It was a refugee settlement, basically. So like we were displaced by warfare and disease and Odinak is the refugee settlement.
Did you have feelings or concerns about like keeping your community's story safe, even as you're sharing it with a wide audience?
Yeah, there's definitely concerns. Like there's part of that, even that song that I'm like skipping over in the translation that are more spiritual, because I feel like, folks feel really entitled to that part, but they don't, the spiritual elements, but they don't want to talk about the colonial history. And so like, I do want to share as much as possible about like our real history because it's so, erased by media and by the education system and everything, you know, especially in the Northeast, people can drive through Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine and have no idea how to even learn about, the indigenous people of that place, let alone that we still exist.
So like you're still here.
Yes.
This is like a continuously evolving story. It's not like something that is just in a dusty history book that no one's reading for some reason.
Yeah. And like, not only are we still here, but like, we're still, you know, our culture is still evolving and like, we're still like, we have, an aesthetic kind of culture all of our own that like, you know, people really don't think that indigenous folks have like influenced American musics, for instance, and indigenous musical ideas have been at the center and like a part of it throughout the development of like all American musics, right? So
yes. Okay, I want to talk about lineage. It's the second part of the first movement. I feel your bass playing so strongly in this composition, kind of as a main character, as much as it is a rhythmic element. Like it's like this sort of pulsing constant for the first 5 minutes and then starts to kind of walk around and dance. And then it settles back into this like deep clarity at the end. Mm. If you had to describe this character and their story, what would it be?
Yeah. So the composition that I made for this, it's like very minimal. There's only like a couple of written things, but the time signature that I wrote in this was timeless, because that is what I wanted the overall energy to reflect, like the timelessness of lineage, right? So there is like a pulse, there is like, you know, even if you wanted to say that it's in 7-8, like you could say that, but like it's loose because...
Well, I feel better because I was like, I feel a pulse and yet I'm having a lot of trouble counting this song. And maybe it's because I didn't go to a fancy music school, but now I feel vindicated.
Yes. Please feel vindicated. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and the bass part is supposed to represent, I think, the the continuity, I guess, of the people.
It's the people. If there was not a ton written for this composition, can you talk about the environment in the studio that led to the recording that came out on the final track? Like, how did you get your people to be like in the headspace that you wanted to create this story?
Yeah. So we did a lot of talking about ancestors. I think that's like the major space that this album lives in. I'm the only Indigenous person on in the band on that recording, but I think we all held like a very deep reverence for ancestors, everyone in that musical experience. And so I was just really encouraging people to tap into like what lineage means to them and ancestry and the stories through colonial times that we have all lived through, all of our people, all of our communities and ancestors, you know. And I think that did a lot for setting the like emotional and spiritual sphere for that recording.
Now, did you sing live with the band when you recorded it?
Yeah, I did. And Miriam El-Hajli, the other lead vocalist, also did.
Wow. That I felt like there were some moments, especially towards the end of the track, where there was like this incredible tension and like kinship between the vocal and
I can't remember who's playing last in it.
Anyway, there's like there's like Molly and say the name of the other vocalist again.
Miriam.
It's like this really tense, cool, dissonant moment where the vocals weave in with the other instruments, and it's these very like high, almost stressful tones. Can you talk about those moments and like what part of the story that's speaking to?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely speaking to like the last few hundred years in America. But you know, that wasn't a defined like part of the composition necessarily. I think we just all got there, like we really needed to like air our pain and anger, you know, together.
Now, that's a quality of your voice that I haven't heard very much. I think you really feel the transition away from the like close and very warm harmonies of Lula Wiles to this like just as embodied but very different type of wail. Like, how does it feel to share that other side of your voice with people that have gotten to know you in a completely different context?
Yeah, I think my singing has definitely been like a journey in this new project, because, you know, with Lula Wiles, it was like so, it had to be perfectly dialed in, like crisp, you know, like very like laser focused tone, no vibrato, no like humanity, for lack of a better term, you know, like harmony singing in that way that Lula Wiles did is like a very scientific thing.
Harmony singing like that can be like, it can feel at once like you are like this zen part of a whole, but then there's also like, I feel like a heartbreaking moment sometimes, like when I've had producers be like, okay, cut the vibrato. And you're like, no, I'm a human. Help. Let me out.
Totally. And that's like, I feel like letting like your real voice do what voices do, which is like they crack, they break, they like get guttural sometimes, you know, like that is the folk music thing for me, you know, like that feels like folk music.
Thank you. Let's talk about Wawa Sintoda. Is that correct?
Yes.
This pronunciation? Okay. So this like is a tone shift, right? This is like the intro to the second movement, and there's sort of a marching band aesthetic, which to me always brings thoughts of like death and machines.
Yeah.
But there's kind of an uncanny cheerfulness to the beginning of this song, which is sort of like a hymn, marching song. So can you talk about your community's relationship with marching band music, marching band instruments, and also like what the hell is the harrowing of hell?
Oh my God. Go. Oh my God. I wish I knew more about what the harrowing of hell was. And I also am glad that I don't, but, okay. So marching band music, this is a big one because this is kind of the beginning of indigenous relationships with jazz, with like early jazz and like ragtime and like the same, I think, as a lot of Black communities in the South, right? In Louisiana, at least, you know, where they were like horn bands starting. And there's like this whole like ecosystem of experimenting with horns and drums, right? And so those instruments were brought to reservations through, I believe through the military first and foremost. Another, like, I guess another understanding of Odinak as it was forming was it was like a kind of a military base, like a colonial base against the Mohawk and the English. We allied with the French, FYI. But so that brought marching band instruments, and also, of course, like the church and the missionaries and the residential schools brought those instruments to our reservations. And all across Turtle Island, you have all of these native marching bands and native big bands popping up in the early 1900s and maybe even the late 1800s. It's like, yeah, it's at the forefront.
For people that are ignorant, can you just talk through a little bit of the residential schools and how that led to like, how that like influenced indigenous culture as a whole? Like there, it played a huge role in like how Native children were like kind of forcefully assimilated into American culture. But can you talk about like the cultural musical side of that?
Yeah. So residential schools were a state sponsored program across the US and across Canada, where they would take indigenous people from their communities, force them into these boarding schools to Christianize them, to estrange them from themselves and from their families. They would abuse them out of speaking their own languages, or, you know, they would cut their hair. It's like a very traumatic, also like trigger warning to people listening. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, you know,
we can share a trigger warning at the beginning of the episode.
Cool. Yeah. I think the last residential school like recently closed. So like, this is like living history, right? And lots of like an entire generation, maybe several of living natives right now are still like living with that trauma. But one way that, I guess one thing that the residential schools did, a way to like get the students more like, I don't know what, attuned to like American culture or like American, like musical ideas, European musical ideas really, was to, teach them to like play in horn bands. And so I think a lot of Native kids like went on to have their own horn bands or join military bands or lead military bands, etc. After residential school.
That is fascinating. So like what we're talking about is basically kidnapping that turned into this musical innovation.
Yeah. I mean, because if you take away every means that kids have to be able to express themselves, but you give them a horn, you know, like what are you going to do?
Well, something really desperate might come out.
Yeah.
And I want people to hear about the harrowing of hell, which is this like sort of off-brand Christian Jesuit myth about Jesus going down into hell to preach to the damned. And I read that that was like this sort of fable that you incorporated into Wawa Sintoda. So why was it important to like include this like very weird sci-fi Christian tale on this record?
Okay, the Catholic fanfic. I mean, frankly,
Catholic fanfic, yes. That's so, what I love love about Catholics. Like, they're not purists at all. Like, they love the fanfare. They love to just, like, add a little pizzazz to the Bible.
Yeah. They're like, here's my version. So,
Taylor's version.
Yes. The Jesuits were early on, like, trying to mess with the Abenakis and the Wabanakis. And so I don't know exactly when this hymn made its way into our community, but it could have been as early as the 1690s. And basically, I haven't been able to find an OG version, like a French or Latin or whatever version, but presumably there is one. And it was translated into the Abenaki language for Wawasin Toda as a means to, like, get us to believe in Jesus. And the translation is hilarious because it's like, you'll find this in a lot of early translations from Catholic into indigenous languages where, like, we don't really have a language of, like, domination and, like, submission the way that, like, the Europeans do. Because that's not really how we think or work at all. And so, like, we have, like, Jesus, our relative? Like, Jesus, our chief? Like, what exactly is Jesus supposed to be? I don't know. But, like, he's going down the stairs and he's retrieving some spirits from somewhere else.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next track, Pedeguadzois. Can you say it again, Molly?
Pedeguadzois.
Okay, I ran up to that and I felt confident and then I lost my confidence. I want to talk about field recordings. So field recordings are kind of the foundation of, like, what we think of as contemporary folk music, Americana music. I feel, and this is not, like, a basic folk official opinion, like, I personally feel that a focus on field recordings can also be used to trap Native Black and Brown communities in amber. Like, these are people of the past. There can be ways in which we listen to field recordings and think, like, okay, these cultures are old timey, and, like, keep minorities out of, like, the present evolving power structure of the music industry. But you took a really, really interesting journey into the field recordings that made it onto Sweet Tooth. So can you talk a little about the process of sorting through those recordings, how you made them feel so contemporary, and, like, how you chose which field recordings to include?
Yeah. So I feel like I can't fully take credit for the idea because I'm really inspired by my friend Jeremy Dutcher, who is a Wollastooki musician, pianist, who released an album that was basically, like, you know, inspiring to me in this way. They used field recordings and kind of just dropped them into the middle of their compositions in a really powerful way. But I wanted to use the actual source recording for Pedeguadzois because it's not a musical offering, right? It's a story. And it's a story in our language, and I wanted to honor a first language speaker of Abenaki to be on this album, to kind of, like, I don't know, you know, I can, like, write as many compositions about the ancestors as I want, you know, but there's only so much material of the ancestors actually telling it the way that it was, you know? And so I wanted to feature that. Yeah. What was the question?
Well, I just think there's a tricky relationship between like sharing recordings that feel and sound like this is an artifact of the past and trying to merge that with like the contemporary reality of like being a person of color, a Native person in contemporary America. So how do you like take something that's like of the past and, for example, like share it with a contemporary audience, share it in a live performance and let people know like this is still living history. These are still like contemporary topics.
Yeah. I mean, I think just like the fact of performing it and, you know, being alive on stage in front of an audience, it like connects dots for people, you know, you're like, oh yeah, like this is how I can picture the guy who's saying this story back in the whatever century. Right. But, but I'm also seeing this like young, hip, like Native person that's, you know, not dressed in full regalia and, you know, doesn't live in a fucking wigwam, you know? Sorry, you'll have to throw
Wait, you don't?
Believe it or not. Actually, though, wigwam just translates to, like, abode. So, technically, we all live in wigwams, but neither here nor there.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah. So, what do you wear on stage when you're performing these types of pieces?
Typically, clothing.
What's your stage fit? Ideally.
You know, I haven't fully conceptualized it yet in First Sweet Tooth because we haven't played the shows yet. But I want to look like I live in fucking 2050.
Yeah.
You know?
Girl it's of really, the future. Person of the future.
Exactly. It's the whole, like, the white gaze thing is really frustrating for us in that way, like, aesthetically, the white gaze. They're like, oh, like, you're not... Why isn't your hair in braids? Like, why aren't you wearing leather? Like, it's something that, like, when I was in Lulu Isles, for instance, like, it was not, like, I didn't feel it as much as I do as a band leader where, like, I don't know, it's something I've really grappled with presenting, like, the Mali Obomsawin show because I'm really taking up Native space and, like, claiming that in a way that, like, I wasn't necessarily doing in, like, a folk band that was all white beyond me. And so, like, it feels a lot more vulnerable to that kind of, I don't know what, audience expectation or presumption.
Right. No, I do think there's, like, a heightened sense of responsibility that is undeniable when you are putting forward a story that, like, says, like, this is, like, an Indigenous story. This is a Native story versus, like, this is a folk album made by three people of, like, varying backgrounds. Like, I think there is a heightened sense of that people that are outside of your community are going to be watching and, like, taking impressions. And, like, that's not exactly fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you live with it.
You have to.
Fractions, which like very much touches on this same topic. Can you talk about the melancholy that like just lives in this track and the storytelling that the acoustic guitar is doing?
The melancholy that lives in this track is the like kind of woozy dystopian experience of like feeling like an entire world has like a microscope to your blood. And like this obsession with like blood quantum, for lack of a better term, right? This like idea that like if you have a drop of Indian blood, then you're like, you know, some kind of exotic, but if you don't have enough Indian blood, you're just like not authentic. It's like this right. whole, it's a very weird thing. It's like kind of the opposite of like the other one drop concept.
What's that?
Do you want to talk about that? I mean,
I think I have a paper bag handy if we need to like review for the audience. No, I mean, I think we're joking about it, but also like there are such real consequences. I mean, there are federal benefits that yeah. come with these like perceived levels of purity of Native heritage, right? Like, can you talk yeah. a little bit about what that feels like and actually like what you wanted to communicate with this particular track about those fractions?
Yeah. That's kind of, you know, it's like a heavy question and like,
yeah.
but I think what people don't understand on the whole is that Indigenous nations are just that. We are nations. We are like mm-hmm. political sovereign entities. And that means that we get to define our citizenship the way that we always have, which is by like kinship, relation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're related to us, you are part of the community. If you like do some serious wrongs, you can get kicked out of the community no matter how sure. pure your blood is, quote unquote, in the Western eye, right?
I hate the word purity so much. I'd love to strike it from the language.
Same. Also probably a word we don't have in the Indigenous language. I could be wrong about that, but you know, conceptually at least I'm right. And so with this track, it's just, I mean, I don't know if I have like a thesis statement other mm-hmm. than I really wanted to communicate that it does a serious number on like the mental health of young Native kids growing up, feeling like their elders or the colonial government or mm-hmm. like the white gaze is imposing some kind of like value hierarchy on like what is in their blood, you know?
Yeah.
It's just fucked.
And it leads really beautifully into Blood Quantum, which is the closing composition on Sweet Tooth. I want to talk about the opening, like, percussion moment.
Yes.
What did you want that drum moment to do in the mind and the body of the listener? And you might have a different answer for Native versus non-Native audiences. Mm-hmm. So where did you land on that?
Honestly, I wanted to, so Savannah Harris is the drummer. Mm-hmm. She's a cool. badass, obviously. And oh, yeah. I basically, you know, I said like, you're going to get us to Blood Quantum from Fractions. And I, you know, that was definitely a moment of like, take us there in the way that you feel it, mm-hmm. you know? So I can't really take any responsibility for the composition of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's beautiful, the trust that you put in her. I mean, it's yeah. so emotive
yeah.
and it's really dark and it kind of is like a wake up call. I felt yeah. as a listener, you're like, we're about to be brought home on this record. Mm. The track begins with this drum solo and it ends with a Penobscot language chant that you co-wrote.
Yes.
So can you describe like the arc of that song, where it begins, where it ends, what was the intention behind it, and like why was it important to include this original chant that you wrote?
Yeah, so the three movements of this suite are kind of addressing different. So the first one is like for the ancestors, right? It's like mm-hmm. Odina lineage. The second one is like the spiritual realm. And the third movement that we're getting into now is, it's for the living, basically. It's like, here's our today mm-hmm. bullshit that we're dealing with. And so Fractions, of course, is the place that a lot of us are coming up in. And, you know, it's more of a question, you know, like, what are we to do with this challenge that we're facing right now as a generation moving forward? And And Blood Quantum, you know, the beginning of this song, I actually wrote for a different project, and I wanted to convey, like, kind of a desolate landscape, frankly, with kind of an undercurrent of, like, anger and modernity and, I don't know, the rock and roll attitude. You know,
you hear that there are like new guitar tones that you hear only on this final track that like we have not been introduced to yet on the album, which is like pretty cool and different than a lot of rock albums I've heard.
Believe it or not, native musical ideas also influenced rock and roll.
You don't say.
You know, that's the place that we're starting in. It's like, okay, emerging from fractions, we're like feeling desolate, we're feeling tired, we're feeling confused, and kind of looking at like what the future could be, you know? And Blood Quantum is like maybe a 12-minute track. It's like quite a journey. And it takes us all the way, you know, through several landscapes, I guess. And I wanted to end with this chant that I wrote with my partner, actually, Lakota Sanborn, and an elder from his community, Carol Dana, who's a language keeper. And the chant translates to, we stand ready to face and fight him. We remember our matriarchs and we honor our grandmothers. And I feel like this is kind of the like ultimate fuck you to the kind of systems of domination we've been talking about, where like Christian culture, Catholicism, colonial systems, right? They have put men, white men, in positions of power over all communities of color, basically, and entire landscapes that are not theirs. They've done a terrible job, of course. They've caused a lot of spiritual harm and trauma, of course. But ultimately, like, Native wisdom has always valued women as the leaders in the community and ultimately, like, the keepers of, like, life-giving powers, you know, of course. And that seems to me like the answer, you know, to put, like, matriarchs back in their rightful place as a means to preserve community and lead us forward.
Can you talk about rematriation? Like, you've given kind of the spiritual and historical framework. How is that term important in your work as an individual, like in your own life, and as far as like being an advocate for land back?
Yeah. So for people who don't know, rematriation is like loosely defined as a reconnection to the motherland and the spiritual practices that come with that. I think I could say it like that. There's like lots of definitions, but with this idea that colonialism in a global sense has severed our umbilical connection to the places that we come from, like the places we really come from, you know, and that has affected different peoples in really different kinds of ways. And the process of rematriation is to renew or resume or reform an umbilical connection, like a motherly connection with the land. And it's like a deep healing practice. It's a religion, you know, it really is. And that's what indigenous communities and myself included, like that's what we're really working on right now is, for in our territory, at least, you know, we are we're working to get land back. We have successfully gotten some land back, and
hell yeah,
yeah, we did that.
You have had some, like, I have learned of some of these significant victories, and it like gives me the chills. This is the real work of like creating the future.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, it is though, you know, and so, but with that, like, it's not just about getting the land back and owning land, you know, it's about like, how do we write our relationship with the land when like the colonial society has forced us to live in ways that are so disrespectful to her, you know? And and a lot of that is resuming and remembering Indigenous ceremonies and, like, land practices, you know, like food ways. But it also, in our, in Wabanaki at least, it's, it means like teaching forward and welcoming those who might not be Indigenous or Wabanaki or whatever, but are living in this land, like teaching those ways so that other people can also root here, you know, if they need to, so that those who have been uprooted through colonialism are not landless and stateless spiritually. Basically, it's like a welcoming practice.
I just wanted to sit with that for a second. That's really powerful to hear. I mean, can you talk a little bit, if you are comfortable, about how the creation of Sweet Tooth tied in with the ways in which you're considering and reconsidering your own gender identity? Like, the rematriation is a huge theme, and I know you and I have talked, like, as friends off mic about, like, what some of the stakes are as far as considering yourself a woman in a minority culture in America, what that means, how that, like, can help and hurt in our own lives, and, like, were there parts of making this record that, like, helped you figure out where you're headed on that journey?
That's a cool question. Yeah, I really appreciated the conversation we had about it, which I'll just kind of summarize a little bit, you know.
Sure, that, we can just paraphrase.
Basically, you know, if I'm considering myself in, like, the American gender landscape, I'm like, I am not really interested in participating in, like, American femininity. Like, I've never related to it. I've always been more of a, like, for, to use an outdated term, tomboy, you know, and like, just really, like, and never really, like,
well, and I don't want to speak for you, but, like, we talked about this on tour, like, as a woman of color, we were never invited. Like, it wasn't even a question of, like, do I feel like a woman? It was like, you were told you are not a part of this. You are not pretty. You are not protected. You are not held on a pedestal in the way that, like, white womanhood was constructed to be. Like, you're just not even in the running. So you had to, like, come up with your own gender identity outside of that. And I know that that's something that you're still, like, working with. And then there's this whole other side of it, which is,
which is, like, we have lived and been part of this community of, like, other, women of color who have been, like, denied that kind of recognition of femininity, or, you know, on par level with, like, white womanhood or whatever. And to, like, to kind of discard that and be like, you know what, actually, like, I'm non-binary and that's it. And, like, don't call me a woman is kind of to, like, throw away, like, it feels disrespectful to the, like, experience that we have had with our communities of, like, you know, like, I don't, you know, I'm not a part of that anymore. Like, I'm just gonna, like, forget that I went through that with you.
Right. Like, there's a sisterhood that you have to honor even as your own, like, individual sense of, like, where you fit in the universe is changing. Like, both things are true at the same time.
Exactly. And and, you know, and I think that's, it's good to honor that it's more complicated than, like, a binary, like a yes or no, or like a they or a she or whatever. But, like, that all being said, in my own community and in, like, Indigenous practices and conceptualizations of, like, womanhood, like, it's incredibly empowering. And, like, of course I'm recognized as that. And I, like, I accept that role and responsibility, you know, because it does feel, like, so much more free. Because, like, femininity is a spectrum in, but it's a sacred spectrum. You know, any part of you that's on that spectrum is sacred, whether you have a vagina or not.
Oh my gosh, I want to cheer and clap for that final comment. Oh my gosh, thank you for going there with me. I think this is a topic that I've, like, been wanting to talk more about through Basic Folk, and I think, like, your story and this album are, like, such a beautiful road into, like, getting free from a lot of the concepts of gender, genre, etc., borders, you know? So thank you for, like, being willing to be transparent about that on the podcast.
Hell yeah.
My final question relates to where you are physically right now. You're about to record a new album. So who is Feather Bitch? What can you tell us about what's coming?
Cool. Feather Bitch is the most powerful version of myself, where she does and says exactly what she wants. She only, she doesn't apologize for being anti-colonial.
Cool.
And she's my like rock star alter ego. And she is also a band where I play guitar and sometimes electric bass and sing. And she is making an album right now.
I am so excited to hear it. I think it's going to be a horse of a completely different color than Sweet Tooth or Lula Wiles releases. Like I've gotten a sneak peek of some of these tracks on tour, and people are going to lose it over this new album.
Thank you. I hope so.
Molly, thank you so much for coming back to Basic Folk to talk about your new music. Are you willing and able to do a brief lightning round where you just take some quick questions and shoot from the hip?
Yes, I can try. I'm so bad at these.
Jeans or sweatpants?
Sweatpants.
Planes, trains, or automobiles?
Oh, trains?
Trains are good. You're doing great so far. What is the best holiday?
Oh, Hanukkah?
Do you have any pre-show rituals?
Going pee.
Peeing is so important.
It really is.
What would you like to eat at your last meal on Earth?
Oh my God. Fried green tomatoes.
Yum. Yeah. Who is your celebrity crush?
Buffy St. Marie, I don't know.
Oh, wow. Yeah, babe. So babe basic. Town.
Yeah, true, though.
What color is your soul?
Oh, orange?
You need to meet Will Sheff of Acreville River. finally, do you know any jokes?
No. Only colonialism is a fucking joke.
It's not funny, but it is a joke.
Yeah.
Molly of Amsouin, thank you so, so much. Again, everybody go out and listen to her new album, Sweet Tooth. Listen in a darkened room and get ready to dance and cry.
Please. Thank you so much.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by John Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find us there. You can find us on the SiriusXM app by searching for Basic Folk. You can listen wherever you get podcasts or go to our website, basicfolk.com. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. You are special. We care about you. Have a lovely day. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.